Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-hosts Tom Coffeen and Scott Hoag. And today, you've got the three of us because we're going to do listener questions. And I guess we can just dive straight into it and talk about some of the questions that we commonly get, both from folks who are sort of posting stuff around the podcast, but also just, you know, in our regular day-to-day activities, because all three of us are sort of instructors and consultants around IPv6, and we get all sorts of crazy questions around what's going on with IPv6. So maybe we can jump into some of them. I think the common one that I hear all the time is stuff around NAT and network address translation. I don't know if you guys hear the same thing, but maybe we can start there. Does that sound good?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've heard variations of this question, and we were just discussing this before jumping on the podcast. It shows up in different ways. So I think one of the more common wordings that I hear is, well, you're telling me that I'm going to be using global unicast address space. Once they understand what that is, and that the fact that it's essentially a public address, we go from having a private address internally to having a public address in the form of a GUA address. And so then, of course, the question becomes, well, okay, we're not doing NAT anymore. NAT goes away. We're telling them that NAT goes away. It's like, well, hey, I thought I was getting a bunch of extra security by having NAT. And that boils down to the idea that, oh, well, the internal IP topology is obscured from the out or to the outside world. And so therefore there's additional security that comes from that. And so that's one of the first things that we end up having to shoot down, right? The whole idea that you're getting security from network address translation.
I think enterprises, the fact that they use private addresses internally, and then they feel like someone couldn't map out their internal topology on the outside because of the NAT function. But what they fail to realize is the vastness of the IPv6 global address space that they'll be using inside. And it's difficult to map that out remotely. Enterprises may fail to recognize that if they were using all global IPv6 address space internally, that if they had a piece of malware internally, it could be mapped out anyway. Knowledge of your address is not a security measure you can count on.
Mm-hmm. It maybe falls in two sets of areas, right? Around the NAT for security, and then also the mindset that's been sort of confused around the fact that NAT was really about address conservation, right? The two are so commonly linked together of saying, like, I just don't have enough V4, and therefore the necessary thing to do is to NAT because I need to conserve how many public addresses I'm actually utilizing. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of comes from the other angle, which is like, I can take lots and lots of people and hide them behind this singular address. What they don't realize is that actually hurts you from a reputation basis in the bigger internet too, right? Because now I can't discrete who you are and who a bad actor is. He can hide behind multiple layers of NAT, and therefore everyone who's inclusive within that global address range that's being overloaded also gets marked with the same bad behavior, right? I can't tell the difference between any of you, so I'm going to mark all of you as bad actors. And this happens pretty commonly in terms of sort of like the, you know, trying to determine someone within maybe a carrier grade NAT configuration for an entire neighborhood. One bad actor can knock out an entire neighborhood for a service, for instance, mm-hmm. because they're all hidden behind that, which is actually the reverse of having better security, right? I mean, this forces the operator of that service to basically say, like, I can't trust those addresses or that singular address, even though there may be 60,000 people hidden behind it or 30,000 people hidden behind it. I can't trust it. Therefore, none of those people get to use the service because of one bad actor who's behind it.
Mm-hmm. There's an RFC for that. 4864, local network protection for IPv6, that goes through all of the arguments about why a NAT may be comfortable to a security administrator, but actually not needed in an IPv6 network. Goes through the arguments you just made, Ed, about you don't need NAT for IPv6 for adding IPv6 addresses. You've got plenty of those, and it doesn't really provide you any level of security. It's the statefulness in your perimeter firewalls that'll allow outbound connections statefully and remove the state when the connection is torn down and prevent unsolicited inbound connections to your global address space you're using internally. That's the function that, will keep you safe.
Exactly.
Also, if you were using an outbound web content filter, to prevent users from going to bad sites. Because it's acting like a proxy, it has that NAT-like function, but it's really a proxy. It's not intentionally doing NAT. Like many people think of port address translation on their typical perimeter firewall. But you know, when you do any kind of inbound or outbound, you know, forward or reverse proxy, or have a caching proxy or web content filter, it will be doing that type of function. But you know, it's also applying some security policy as well, and probably looking for downloads of files and making sure that they don't contain malware. It does other security functions.
Right. And certainly people use DNS appliances to do the exact same thing in a similar mm-hmm. way, right? Just avoid mm-hmm. the bad actors entirely by using mm-hmm. a better security tool, and catching that at the DNS level is probably the best way to do it. Just kill it before it even makes it outbound.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about the next generation of security admins that are coming up, but maybe there's less emphasis on the perimeter model of security. Obviously, there's an awareness of it. There always is, but less mm-hmm. Sort of overprivileging the perimeter model, assuming that, oh, because you know I've got a border and I've got devices at that border that are there to, you know, check state, as you mentioned, on traffic passing between the outside network and the inside network, and doing IDS and IPS functions. You know, therefore, I have this green network internally that's secure, and a red network outside that isn't. And I don't know, like over time, maybe that's getting less and less sort of compelling in terms of, you know, if I'm a security admin, I'm aware that I can have, you know, multiple infected devices internal to my network that are creating issues, and that I have to track down, and that the perimeter doesn't really do anything to stop in that regard. It's porous.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the industry is swinging towards realizing that edge compute devices and the porousness of all services being sort of cloud enabled, and therefore, you know, what constitutes my corporate network anymore, with all my employees going out to Office 365, or even one from home going to Office 365, and how does that look different than my corporate resources that I'm running? Things like that mm-hmm. make it a lot more complex. And I think I do agree that the landscape is changing in terms of how folks are thinking about what is their corporate network, right? What yeah. actually defines a corporate net?
But, yeah, certainly enterprises that have a large remote, you know, virtual workforce, it's turned inside out.
Right. But I mean, this is true for V4 or V6. I don't mm-hmm. think there's any distinction between which network protocol you use and how that affects you. I think the principal difference is just the comfort level of how does the use of NAT really impact. I think the second question is a follow-up, maybe it's the natural follow-up to this, is should I be matching or mapping out what I do with IPv4 into IPv6? In other words, I'm using RFC 1918 space, and I'm using a stateful packet inspection device that utilizes NAT that puts me on a global, you know, a global IPv4 address space. So I've got this RFC plus NAT plus stateful packet inspection to get out to the internet. Shouldn't I be building the same thing in IPv6? Shouldn't I be constructing the same sort of, basic core fundamentals of my network build out? Shouldn't it look the same? Mm-hmm. And that's the other question that I think we get, because they just don't know IPv6 at all. So you're sort of like, hey, I should just match what I already got, right?
Yeah, and we tend to recommend that, right? If you're using OSPF-V2 for V4, it makes sense to use OSPF-V3 for your IPv6 routing protocol. If you're using DHCP V4 today to assign addresses and leases to nodes, use DHCP for IPv6, you know, follow the same operational model. But in this case, you know, the models are different. You're going to use global addresses internally and externally.
That's right. And it's because the address architecture in IPv6 is so fundamentally different, right? Because if you start off from the premise that, oh, I'm really just sort of dealing with the same complement of address space in V4 that I have in V6, then it would make sense to model the address architecture in terms of how it's laid out, both, you know, physically or in terms of how addresses get put on infrastructure, but also in terms of like your address plan. And obviously in V6, or as we've tried to make, you know, we've emphasized over and over again, you really need a proper IPv6 address plan. And that really comes from understanding the fundamental difference in the address architecture, where you have just a huge amount of address space that you're working with. And so a corollary risk with that, the whole idea that you're just going to match what you're doing in V4 with V6 is that you might, you know, one of the more boneheaded things you could do is like, well, I've got this V4 address plan and I'm going to basically try to model the exact same address plan in V6.
Well, tell us how you really feel about it, Tom.
Well, can you imagine a more, you know, I can't imagine a more sort of disastrous outcome for an enterprise going forward, like trying to basically tie everything back to IPv4 when they've got this incredible opportunity to do things from scratch, from the ground up, with, you know, essentially unlimited address space.
Right.
And, you know, the ability to sort of conform whatever their network looks like, you know, to an address plan in a way that they've really never been able to do before. So there's like I guess what I'm getting at is that there's this whole other additional risk. It's bad enough if you were thinking, well, I do NAT in IPv4, I'm going to do the same thing in IPv6. I'm going to use unique local addresses, which are kind of equivalent to private address space in V4, but I think all of us would probably agree that it's not the same thing, really, as certainly in terms of how those ranges are allocated, et cetera. You know, so but yeah, you're not going to want to do NAT 6.6 if you can avoid it, in the same way that you wouldn't want to try to tie your V6 address plan back into your V4 address plan for similar reasons, that is.
Yeah, and I think the ULA thing is very confusing for people, because if you don't understand some of the origins of ULA and maybe what its specific use cases actually are, it's very hard to then understand why it is functionally and technically different than RFC 1918 space. It just looks, you know, it's one of those cases where it just it looks too appealing for those that have already been in this function to be like, oh, well, that's what I should use, and I should map to NAT 6.6, and then it looks exactly what I was doing with V4, and I'm comfortable with that, right? It's I'm comfortable in that space, but I would say for many shops, it's a complete mistake to utilize ULA, for a variety of reasons, both technical and then operational, that I think are missing for people. So we could talk a little bit about it, but I don't want to go too far down. My basic recommendation is don't use ULA.
Yeah. Just for listeners who may not know. So unique local IPv6 unicast addresses, RFC 4193, specifies a FC00:7 IPv6 address space that can be used in private networks. So never talking to the internet. And never is a strong word. And then there's 2/8s that roll up to be that FC00/7, FC00/8, which is held in reserve, and FD00/8, which is the ULA address space. You take that FD as the first two hex digits, and then you come up with a 40-bit random number, and then that's your next 40 bits in your address. So the F and the D are 8 bits. The next 40 random bits, that gives you a /48 to be used privately. Well, one, you know, when a customer will come to me and say, oh, let's do ULA, I'm saying, okay, let me create your random number. They're like, oh, that looks terrible. That's like all, it looks like random set of hex digits, and they're going to have to type this in every time. And they say, oh, create me another one. And then I create another random number, and they're like, that one looks even worse. And I'm like, what do you want? Like 00? The point is that the random number avoids overlaps when there's a merger or peering, or someone needs to talk to each other. So what ends up happening is you only get a 48, which is too small for most enterprises. They need more address space. So they need to generate a bunch of these different ULA/48s to be used internally. So they end up with a bunch of really ugly looking random addresses that aren't, you know, they don't summarize up nicely. They're each individual /48s.
Or they ditch the randomness, right? And just, you know, well, we'll just go ahead and use FD00, whatever.
Well, you can always tell the customers that don't understand that written in the RFC is the randomness requirement, and that they chose to ignore it, because you go and you look at their address plan and it's FD00, you know, and it goes through a whole sequence of well laid out address space, and you're like, well, you defeated the purpose of ULA.
Right. And to give them the benefit of the doubt, it's like, well, maybe they did that knowingly, but then of course that breaks the possibility down the road. It's like, oh, we're going to merge with somebody else. Oh, look, they're using exactly the same space because they had exactly the same idea.
Which is the whole problem with RFC 1918, right? Exactly. Everyone was using the same 10 address over and over.
Yeah. So now it's not ULA anymore. It's just LA, It's not unique. Not That's unique. Right. They're using luck.
But yeah, that's it's a structural difficulty, which forces us to be in the bad behavior that we got with IPv4, which is when we did have overlapping RFC 1918, what do? We natted 10 space to 10 space. We couldn't just exchange routes in the natural way that routing protocols want to exchange routes, which is I will take your routes and pass them on and either, you know, subsume them under a better route prefix configuration or something more specific if it's a better topology to get to a location. You break all those capabilities and you're doing this in your corporate network, which just seems foolish. I mean, on the greater backbone of the internet, I can understand why you might structurally have some of these problems, but in your own corporate environment where you control everything, it seems to be foolish to do that to yourself so early on in the game, which is one of the downfalls of for mergers and acquisitions. It's one of the particularly painful things to see go on over and over again, is this readdressing problem and the fact that they can't do true routing as routing anymore because of the need of all the overlapping RFC 1918 space that they have.
Absolutely. And so it really ends up boiling down to, unless you have some sort of regulatory reason to use ULA, just use global unicast address space everywhere. Avoid ULA to the bitter end if you can. And then, you know, if there are those rare corner case requirements where, you know, you might see ULA in a deployment. And then if you do use it properly, use a randomized /48 out of the FD00/8 space. And if you're not doing it that way, then you're going to cause yourself problems down the road.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad to see we're united in our hatred for ULA address space.
It's not hatred. I think it's pragmatic because think about it this way. It's most people aren't aware of this, but in the operating systems, ULA is way down the list of a preferred sort of source address selection methodologies. Most people aren't aware of this because it's sort of hidden from you in terms of what goes on. But the moment your host operating system gets a global unicast address, it's going to prefer it across the board over a ULA address. And it's just the default behavior for how the operating systems work in terms of these preferences and search orders. And that's RFC 6724. And Scott's got all of these off the top of his head. So I think that's the correct one for the source address selection process. And so you can go through and see that every major OS is going to basically not prefer ULA in terms of its possible address selection for any V6 related address. So you do run into the potential scenario from just a security standpoint of saying, like, we're always going to operate in ULA, and you get the one use case where something pops up on the network and it's got a global unicast and advertises, and next thing you know, everything's got that. They're all going to flip over to using that global unicast address. So it doesn't put you in a better situation. Your best situation is a global unicast address because it is the most trusted preferred address on a host operating system. The only corner cases you get into is when you have multiples on your system. And you can still control that because you can control how, you know, Slack or DHCP V6 works to control whether the host operating system gets a single global unicast address or whether it gets multiples, you know, how that behavior really works. That's optionally yours, but you can only really do that if you're using global unicast. Anyway, small little nuance difference for the listeners if they care to dig into it. That's where you go to find out. Geeky stuff we get to go over. I mean, is there something we want to talk about a little bit about security and sort of like where things fit in the security landscape? Because I think those are the other common questions, like, oh my gosh, this V6 thing, my tools don't support it. I don't understand how to, you know, get information out of my systems around IPv6. Mm-hmm. Like, that seems to be the other real common, you know, fear factor. I mean, I've seen projects halted because the security group came in and said, thou shall not deploy IPv6 because we lack the capabilities to do anything with IPv6. And therefore, our quickest answer is just don't do anything with it. I'll turn it off, or, you know, I don't know what everyone does, because I just run away from those cases. But
And there's our listener question. I disable IPv6 whenever or wherever I can, and is that a bad thing to do? And the answer is yes, it's a terrible thing to do, and let's talk about why.
People who turn it off, did they write down all the places they turned it off? Because now when it comes time to enable IPv6, they've just added workload. They've made enabling IPv6 that much more difficult, because it was always in the end host by default, enabled by default automatically to save yourself work later. Now you just made it more difficult for yourself. Mm-hmm. And you didn't keep track of all those places that you pushed out that GPO or turned it off manually. Well,
the good news, if you use a GPO, you just reapply a net new GPO to re-enable and then hit the button and hopefully it goes out to all the devices that are actually demanding.
Right. If you're properly managing the network.
If you're properly managing all your resources that way, at least on the Windows side. But on the Linux side, I mean, it can be problematic in terms of trying to figure out what's going on there. And even for just client operating systems for unmanaged resources, like just, you know, regular, you know, folks running in with guestnet services and everything else. I don't think people realize the challenge of quote unquote saying our default policy is that all devices must turn off IPv6. I wonder how they go about and do that on printers and on cameras that support it and on IoT devices. Like, it's a common question. I ask them, I say, are you really turning it off everywhere? And they're like, oh yeah, absolutely. And then we go through this litany of other devices that they have. And they're like, well, we don't know what those do. And I'm like, well, that means that it's probably turned on.
And they're like, well, you didn't turn it off at your employees' homes.
Yeah.
You didn't turn it off in the employees' phones that they bring into the office. They're in their pockets or purses.
Right.
Yeah, you didn't turn it. You didn't uncompile it out of the Windows kernel. You can still ping ::1.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't turn it off when your salesperson goes to a conference in a foreign country or has it in their hotel room. You didn't turn it off everywhere. Mm-hmm. You're just going to live in fear of something you don't know. I'd say instead of being fearful, learn about the protocol, turn it on, be in charge of it, be in control of it, enforce your policies on it, and make sure your policies are consistent for V4 and V6, and you won't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like a classic example of security where someone says, oh, I've turned it off, or IPv6 doesn't affect me, is VPNs. We have a corporate VPN that does no split tunneling. Why? Because we're fearful that traffic may break out of the VPN and go directly to the thing on the internet. So for our remote users, we do no split tunneling. Well, great. If your remote user is on an IPv6 network, they're going to get an A record and a quad A record for some cloud-based service.
Mm-hmm.
The V4 default route and the no split tunneling is going to direct the V4 connection down in through the corporation. But thanks to happy eyeballs, the end user being on a V6 network, they're going to make a V6 connection to that cloud provider. And if happy eyeballs does a race between V4 and V6, V4 is going to be slower, you know, not only because tunnel overhead and you're backhauling it, your V6 is going to be faster. Your end users are going to make V6 connections out on the internet. So your no split tunneling didn't help you. So what could you do? Well, create an IPv6 capable VPN service and enforce no split tunneling on that, and then bring it back into your corporation and send them through your corporate perimeter security measures. And you're doing the same functionality for V4 and V6, and you're more in control of your own destiny rather than fearful of what may be out there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're really throwing the gauntlet down here by saying, you know, you do this in the short term because you think you're creating more security for yourself, but in the long term, in the medium to long term, you're actually making your entire operation less secure by not understanding how the protocol works. You know, just to boil it down to a few words, and I guess it does sort of spin out from, what's the reason you turned it off in the first place? Did you turn it off because you were fearful, because you were uncertain, you had your doubts about, you know, how to manage it, etc.? Did you turn it off, like in isolated cases, maybe you turned it off because you're doing some troubleshooting, and, you know, maybe it's the shortest path to sort of figuring out, isolating the problem and figuring out what it is from a particular host. You know, that might be okay, but, you know, then you're not faced with this larger problem of figuring out several weeks or months down the road, where did I turn it off, and what was the original reason for that? So yeah, we're trying to remove the excuses just in your mind that you might be making to yourself related to, you know, why you're turning IPv6 off in the first place, which, you know, really boils down to just, you know, maybe not wanting to take the extra time or feeling, you know, let's face it, there's a lot of constraints in enterprise networks related to time and how much time you have to spend on learning new things. And, you know, it may be difficult to do, but it doesn't make the security problem go away by just ignoring the fact that it's on your network and it's running and all the ways that we just described, that the ways that you just described, Scott, you know, where it's operating and you're not managing it. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, people probably turn it off because they encountered some troubleshooting, because they lack familiarity with one of the address families, mm-hmm. IPv6. They just narrowed it down the possibilities to a single address family. And the system probably was having a problem over IPv6, mm-hmm. but they didn't care to dig any deeper to figure out maybe why that device was trying to activate a tunnel and that was the source of their issues, right. or something like that.
That's right.
No, and then, tunnels.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and then of course, you know, maybe 10 years ago you could be excused for making the argument, well, the host operating system really isn't handling IPv6 gracefully. There might be some issue in terms of how it's managing the address families, et cetera. And if those excuses are gone, the host operating mm-hmm. systems are all performing quite well with IPv4 and IPv6. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, I'd never neglect to mention this fact, and I don't know what the current status of it is, but for years it's been problematic to disable IPv6 in Windows based on the level of support you're getting from Microsoft for the operating system. If you need that support and they, you know, you're requesting it and they ask, have you disabled IPv6? And you're like, yes. Well, okay. Well,
please
re-enable it. You're out of scope for support. You know, you're operating an untested environment. We can't guarantee that the fix that we provide will work for your environment.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. Microsoft is, I don't think that's as big of an issue today, because before it was something about, it was really that transition period when they moved onto Vista in sort of 2012 when they made significant changes to the networking stack. The reality is today, you can't even, it's so hard to actually turn off IPv6 in a Windows operating system. Like, they've made it so difficult to fundamentally do.
You think you've disabled it, but.
Yeah, but you really haven't. it's one of those funny, like, we're just going to fake you out and nod our head to tell you that it's off, but it really isn't. I mean, if you need to do if you're actually exploited on the box and you just do a call to, you know, ::1, it's always going to reply. That's never turned off. It's not possible to actually turn that off because of the way the networking stack was rewritten for Windows. V4 and V6 are tied at the hip. It's not actually, now the reverse happens to be true too. So when we get to a V6 only network operations and you're like, we need to turn off V4, you're not going to be able to turn off V4 either until they redo the networking stack for the next time around to turn off V4. So that's equally true in the other direction when we get there. I think to Scott's point earlier, sort of mentioning around some of the tunneling stuff, especially around Windows, is Microsoft just decided to get rid of all those transition services for tunneling. You know, Teredo 64, Isotap, all those things are now turned off by default. The host operating system shouldn't have to do any of those sorts of things anymore. That really should be, you know, core capability should be pushed to the network now. They were doing that early on to sort of help with the transition, the early transition of you know, folks adopting IPv6. But today, given the uptick in service provider and home networks, residential providers, and hopefully enterprises here, you know, you just don't need those transition technologies to exist in the operating system anymore. So they pretty much have turned all of those off by default. You can still enable them if you need them, but they turn them off by default from a behavior basis inside those host OSs.
Yeah, and they're in the process of being deprecated, and yeah, certainly not needed anymore.
Yeah, we don't need that stuff anymore. We don't need training wheels. That's how I look at them, training wheels. They were really complex training wheels that didn't work very well most of the time. That was the other problem with them, to be honest, is that mm-hmm. they weren't particularly, but while they definitely worked, they didn't work at scale the way you would anticipate that they, or would hope that they would, especially around mm-hmm. large-scale enterprise. It's definitely caused a lot more headache in terms of understanding what's going on, because as everyone who's a networking person knows, tunnels are convenient in terms of certain things, but they do make it a lot harder to troubleshoot what exactly is going on in mm-hmm. your network, because you're just bypassing whole sections of networks that could be, you know, on the underlay side, whole sections of network that look like a single link in your tunnel, but in reality are like, you know, 20 links deep of something else going on the underlay, and you have no clue, no visibility, and that's really hard to figure out what exactly is happening. So getting away from that is a good thing, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those were the quick questions that we, just for the listening audience, those are the quick questions that we sort of distilled down. We get these over and over again, so we didn't credit them to any particular individual, but these were the very, very common ones that we see and hear, on a very, very much an ongoing basis, especially in the mm-hmm. classes that we teach and things like that. So we mm-hmm. thought we'd bring them up because you know, we felt like it was good to sort of get it out there as a general thing, instead of having to repeat ourselves over and over again in a class, although we'll still do that. So it's nice to get it on a podcast. Say, like, just please go listen to this, and you can hear all the arguments around it. Was there anything else you guys wanted to add?
Well, just one more question related to security, which we mentioned related to NAT at the top, and then the whole idea of disabling IPv6 and saying, you know, that's a terrible idea. Once you've decided that you're going to plunge ahead with it and you've got your /64 configured on your LAN interface, related to your security posture, a question that we see come up, how feasible is it to scan an IPv6 network to discover devices that are running on that segment? You know, it's a relatively common practice in V4 for security audits and network discovery tools to do that. Is that something that you can even do in IPv6?
Yeah, that's really problematic. And many of the vendors that have, you know, network-based vulnerability scanners that they, you know, sell to enterprises for scanning their internal, you know, let's say /16 or something, or even their RSC 1918 address space, it can scan, and it can scan day in, day out, looking for nodes and find them and then do, you know, a network-based, port-based scan. Those systems wouldn't have the ability to scan a /32 that would be allocated to that, you know, large international enterprise. So the vulnerability scanners, they all the major ones, enterprise-grade vulnerability scanning platforms do support IPv6, but they have to be loaded with individual IPv6 host addresses. So the full 128-bit addresses of the prefix and the interface identifier need to be loaded into that scanner, and they will scan them one at a time. Mm-hmm. So how do you come up with that list? That's kind of the challenge for many enterprises, is how do I come up with the list of all the V6 addresses? And I have to know all the privacy addresses and the temporary addresses. There's a couple of ways where you can glean those addresses from. You can glean them from neighbor cache of all your layer 3 access routers, you know, your first hop, you know, gateways. You could glean them from your DHCP v6 leases. You do a bulk lease query or something, pull them out of your DDI platform. You could, you know, find them in other places, you know, and load them in manually. Mm-hmm. But then also, it changes the nature of vulnerability scanning. So if you're doing credential-based, agent-based scanning, that still works over IPv4 and IPv6. So if you had some agent in the server, in the operating system that's scanning credentialed scans internally, that's still valid. The other thing I do like to tell people is, if your vulnerability scanning is working over IPv4, that's okay, because if you have a problem, or it sees that a patch is missing for over V4, that same patch being applied could help you fix some problem with IPv6. So making sure you're up to date patching wise, whether the telemetry is being performed over V4 or V6, it's just good to keep things patched and know when you're out of compliance there. Mm-hmm. So if the management plane of that vulnerability analysis system uses IPv4, at least it'll be telling you about all the software patches that you're missing, and those software patches will include fixes for V4 and V6. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things I tend to think about or talk about when someone's concerned that their vulnerability scanner can't scan, you know, their /48.
Yeah, or, you know, at the LAN level, a /64. And what just to be clear for listeners who may not be as familiar with IPv6, it's not even possible to do it, right? I mean, it's just like if you're brute force scanning all the addresses, attempting to do that in even the smallest subnet, which is a /64, what is 1.8 times 10 to the 19th addresses?
18 quintillion, yeah.
Yeah, like, so you end up with, you know, yeah, I can go ahead and scan that subnet for you. It'll take basically more time than has elapsed since the origin of the universe. But yeah, so stand by. I'll have that list for you shortly.
Yeah, waiting. Waiting. Hourglass. Wheel.
Yeah, because it's what is it? If you do like 1 a second or something like that, it's like 5 billion years or something for a /64 or something in that neighborhood. I can't remember all the math.
Yeah,
I don't think it's relevant once you get past more than, you know, you probably, once you get past more than a month, most people are going to be like, this is ridiculous. Where by the time we loop back around to catch the front again, it's totally pointless. Mm-hmm. You're not getting useful information because you got too big of a gap period for understanding the state of things. Mm-hmm. So maybe the question is, with the advancement of tooling around doing things like querying against the routers and switches for like, hey, give me your neighbor discovery tables, right? Like, tell me what's actually running on the network and has popped up versus, because all these network devices actually have to learn what's operating on the network, right? And they keep a cache table that tells them where stuff is. You're probably better off utilizing, you know, active querying tools that go out and solicit that information from your network gear than you are simply trying to brute force, you know, scan a network and try and determine what's actually running on it. While that was possible, very feasible in V4, I think in V6, it's a change of strategy. Although there's some arguments to be made about, you know, predictability of V6 address, you know, sort of address plans and how people plan around them and how they build scopes and common address bad behavior, right? Like saying, oh, I'm going to use, you know, :, you know, 125, 126, 127. Like they start repeating some of the behaviors that they use in IPv4 in the same way in IPv6, which may or may not be a bad thing for, you know, server-side data center deployments. Maybe some predictability in address space is not such a horrible thing, but it does make it more predictable in terms of finding a set of addresses. But even if you were able to cut down in half what you were doing, you went from 5 billion years to, you know, 2.5 billion years, I think.
It's still a problem. It's still 2.5 billion years.
Still 2.5 billion years. You just found a few more hosts because they were predictable. Yeah. So, well, unlike V6, we run out of space for this podcast because clearly we can't scan enough space to fit into this podcast. So, but, you know, you have the three of us. You can reach out. We've got our typical Twitter handles, so you can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast hosts, which is Tom at IPv6 Tom. You can reach Scott at Scott Hoag, and you can reach me at E Horley. We also have the at IPv6 Buzz set up for a Twitter handle, so feel free to reach out to us. And we absolutely love getting all the listener comments and questions. It's a great way for us to get our next show queued up. But thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. And check out all the other great technical content over at the Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.